This is Lance Lambert speaking, and this is my Middle East update for May 2011. I want to read the words of the Messiah Jesus from Luke's Gospel, chapter 21, from verse 25. And there shall be signs in sun and moon and stars, and upon the earth distress of nations, in perplexity for the roaring of the sea and the billows, men fainting for fear and for expectation of the things which are coming on the world, for the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. But when these things begin to come to pass, look up and lift up your heads, because your redemption draweth nigh. I want to add to that his words again in the Gospel of Mark and chapter 13 and verse 7 and 8. And when ye shall hear of wars and rumours of wars, be not troubled. These things must needs come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be earthquakes in diverse places. There shall be famines. These things are the beginning of travail. I want to add to that, also in the New Testament, the New Covenant, in the letter to the Hebrews and chapter 12. And I will read from verse 26, whose voice then shook the earth, but now he hath promised, saying, yet once more will I make to tremble not the earth only, but also the heaven. And this word, yet once more, signifieth the removing of those things that are shaken, as of things that have been made, that those things which are not shaken may remain. Wherefore, receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us have grace, whereby we may offer service well-pleasing to God, with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. To these I want to add two portions of Psalms in the Old Covenant. In Psalm 93, the 93rd Psalm, the Lord reigneth. He is clothed with majesty. The Lord is clothed with strength. He hath girded himself therewith. The world also is established, that it cannot be moved. Thy throne is established of old. Thou art from everlasting. The floods have lifted up, O Lord. The floods have lifted up their voice. The floods lift up their waves. Above the voices of many waters, the mighty breakers of the sea, the Lord on high is mighty. Thy testimonies are very sure. Holiness becometh thy house, O Lord, forevermore. And lastly, I want to add from the 46th Psalm, from verse 1, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore will we not fear, though the earth do change, though the mountains be shaken into the heart of the seas, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains tremble with the swelling thereof. There is a river, the streams whereof make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacles of the Most High. God is in the midst of her. She shall not be moved. God will help her, and that at the dawn of the morning. The nations raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice. The earth melted. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. We are living in a very troubled world. Massive earthquake in Japan, the strongest ever recorded in her history. The tsunami that followed. The radioactive material that has been let loose. The 680 tornadoes in the United States, normally 1,200 per year. And the one place, Tuscaloosa, flattened in what President Obama called the worst dereliction he has ever seen. It was the worst tornado experience in the States in 80 years. The whole Middle East in flames, from Lebanon to Tunisia to Algeria and Morocco to Libya, Egypt, Yemen, Muscat and Oman, Bahrain, Jordan and Syria. Over 1,000 dead. Actually, altogether many thousands. Osama bin Laden finally assassinated. And much trouble to follow the assassination. Jesus said a phrase that is very interesting, as recorded in Mark's Gospel, chapter 13. He spoke of the beginning of travail, and the word in Greek is birth pangs, the beginning of birth pangs. So it's not just negative. Some translations have called it the beginning of sorrows. But birth pangs is positive. It speaks of the birth of the kingdom. And all these things he spoke about, both in Luke's gospel, in Mark's gospel, and of course also in Matthew's gospel, were to do with the events that would take place before he came. He said, when these things begin to come to pass, lift up your heads, look up, for your redemption draweth nigh. The fact is simple. He is completely in control. That's why I read that marvellous 93rd Psalm in the midst of all the storm and typhoon wind whipping up the waves into fury. It says, the Lord on high is mighty, the enthroned Messiah. And those wonderful words by the writer of the Hebrew letter, we, in the midst of all this shaking, we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. Why can it not be shaken since everything else is shaken? Because the king cannot be shaken. And those whose trust is in the king and who have been saved with an eternal salvation, they are as unshakable as the Messiah himself. In the midst of all this, the Lord has taken our dear brother, David Wilkerson, of the United States. In that terrible car crash in Texas, the Lord took him instantly into his presence. And the last warning voice in the United States is finished. Whether the things he has said will in fact take place remains to be seen, but he was a faithful servant of God who put up with much criticism and a certain amount of antagonism in order to warn the United States that judgment was coming upon her. In this update, we shall cover the assassination of Osama bin Laden and the consequences. The Middle East in uproar with the Arab nations, the Arab nations in foment. What does it mean? Israel, a new situation developing all around her. In the midst of it, what does that mean? The water situation in Israel, the reconciliation of Hamas and Fatah, what does that mean? The situation with two non-Arab but Muslim nations, Iran and then Turkey, and the Godstone report and the retraction by Godstone of part of that report. And finally, the United Nations, the first time intervention in a sovereign nation. What will that mean? First of all, Osama bin Laden's assassination and its consequences. He was assassinated by an American SWAT team, living in a mansion with high walls in northwest Pakistan, just a few kilometers northwest of Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan. Is it possible that the Pakistani government, and especially the Pakistani Security Service, did not know that bin Laden was actually in this mansion right next to an army training camp? It seems extraordinary. Now Pakistan is in foment because of it. It's not just the Middle East, but the whole of Pakistan is in foment, and the leaders of Pakistan are very afraid of the consequences of Osama bin Laden's assassination. They know that the threat of Taliban to kill those leaders for collusion with the United States and so on and so forth is real. One can only believe trouble. It's very interesting to me to see the moderate Muslim leaders in Muslim nations who, with almost without exception, believe that trouble is coming as a result of Osama's assassination. This is not to say, of course, that the assassination wasn't justice finally meted out to this man who caused so much death, both in the United States, in Britain, and in Spain, and elsewhere. But the fact of the matter is that it's almost like swatting a large hornet, and the whole whole hive, the whole nest of hornets come out then to attack you. This man was the one who began the last great war predicted in the Quran. Last great war which will include the destruction of Israel, the annihilation of the Jewish people, and the conquering of the United States and the Western nations. 9/11 in 2001 was the beginning of that war, according to Osama bin Laden and his deputy Sawahri. The success of Al-Qaeda's strategy depends on this huge influx of Muslims into the Western nations and elsewhere, by conversion, by funding, and by simple reproduction. His death by assassination, as I have said, will have very real consequences. He died in the eyes of most militant and fundamentalist Muslims as a martyr, and it will probably lead to the recruitment of millions of young Muslim men and women, fired and energized with a new passion for Islam. Nazism, which brought so much trouble to us all here in this part of the world, was a spiritual force, not a political force. Basically and essentially, Nazism was a spiritual force, and so is militant Islam. It is not a political force. It is a spiritual force. I used to go and speak many years ago in a company in Linz in Austria. In the assembly was Eichmann's father and mother, his brother and his sister and their families, Adolf Hitler's chauffeur, Gottfried Schneemann, and Adolf Hitler's train driver. It was a very extraordinary assembly to visit. I always had marvellous times with them. And I remember speaking with Herr Knöppel, who was the Sunday school teacher of little Adolf Eichmann. And he told me that he was such a nice boy. He grew up so well and so on, and everything seemed wonderful. And then suddenly, he said, in his teens, he totally changed. He became a different person. It was almost as if he'd had a kind of temperamental and personality change, and he could not understand it until he found out that was the day he joined the Hitler Youth. I have no doubt in my mind that Adolf Eichmann was possessed by a demon. And from the very moment he joined that thing, some spiritual force got into him, and the result was a hatred for the Jewish people and everything connected with us. I think it's the same thing to do with militant Islam. I think that there are demonic forces at work. The readiness to commit suicide, the readiness to completely forget oneself and be energized by another force. It just seems to me that this is the character of militant Islam. Then I would like to say something about the Middle East. It is obvious to all of you who hear me, if you have television, if you listen to radio, that the Arab nations are in foment. We have never seen anything like this. There's never been a popular revolution in Arab society. It all began in Lebanon with the government of Hariri, the son of the Hariri who was Rafik Hariri, who was assassinated by Syria and by orders from Iran. He was leading a government, and in order to get national unity, had a number of Hezbollah members of his government. And they suddenly resigned en masse, all of them. This brought about the collapse of the government, and the result was that a man who is very sympathetic to Hezbollah became the leader of Lebanon. This contagion, which was different in the Lebanon, but just as serious, I might underline and emphasize, then seemed to spread to Tunisia, where for the first time the most moderate of the Arab states, Tunisia, with a large middle class, suddenly became completely infected. People didn't seem to worry that they were being murdered, shot dead in the streets. It didn't worry them, but they just came out in greater numbers. Until finally Ben Ali, who had been for all these decades president of Tunisia, fled to Saudi Arabia. And it then spread to Algeria, which we heard very little about, because the Tunisian thing was so dramatic that it seemed to expel the other news. Both Algeria and Morocco experienced great unrest and much popular protest. Then it spread to Egypt, where, of course, the whole world became focused upon the Egyptian revolution. Mubarak had been in charge for 40 years. He had watched over and protected the peace treaty with Israel. Whatever we may feel about Mubarak, he in fact was a force for stability and peace, as was Ben Ali in Tunisia. Then it spread, of course, to Libya. And, of course, the world has been centred on the Libyan revolution and the fighting between the rebels and Gaddafi and his forces. It then moved to the Yemen. Again, a president who's been for 40 years president of Yemen and has given stability to Yemen, has fought the Al-Qaeda forces in Lebanon. They are actually present in the Yemen and much else. Huge demonstrations in Yemen. And then it spread to, of all places, Muscat and Oman, which has been very peaceful, and where they actually allowed Christian work. It's amazing. And then to Bahrain, where they've been even more reform-minded. And then to Jordan, and finally to Syria, where it has been just as bad as Tunisia, and Egypt and Libya. It is incredible to see all this. What does it all mean? The end result is definitely a new Middle East. If it was real democracy, with honestly elected members of parliament and an independent judiciary and true freedom, it would be something to hail. If it was all of this, it would be good. I think the real gain from all this unrest in all the nations around Israel, like a circle, will be for militant and fundamentalist Islam. The Muslim Brotherhood will be the real victor. They are the largest organization in Egypt. They are banned, by the way, in every Arab state. They're banned in Tunisia, they're banned in Libya, they're banned in Algeria, they're banned in Morocco, they've been banned in Egypt, they're banned in the Yemen, they're banned in the oil sheikhdoms, they're banned in Jordan, and they're banned in Syria. Banned, by the way, in Iraq too. Why do all these governments ban the Muslim Brotherhood? Because the way they speak sounds very pleasant and very democratic and very much for freedom and so on. But I think the leaders of the different nations know very well what the Muslim Brotherhood has as its aim. They will use democracy to destroy democracy. The leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, I listened to him, I heard him myself, called it Islamic democracy. That means that Christians and Jews are very much second-class citizens, and it means that there is no real thing as democracy. Hitler did exactly the same thing. He was elected in 1933, if my memory is correct, and then proceeded to destroy democracy by democracy. Then I would like to say something about Israel in the midst of all this foment. What does it all mean for Israel? Israel undoubtedly now faces a new situation. She is surrounded by Muslim Arab nations who believe that she must be destroyed. If the purpose of Allah for the world is to be fulfilled, and if the Quranic strategy is to be completed. Already Egypt has openly discussed tearing up the peace treaty with Israel. It has reopened entrances to Gaza, which is very serious as far as we're concerned. It has made an alliance with Hamas. By the way, the name Hamas is the Palestinian name for the Muslim Brotherhood. The reason they have called themselves Hamas is that the Muslim Brotherhood is banned in all these Arab countries. When Gaza was under Egypt, it was banned. So they call it Hamas, which means like anger or uprising. There have been calls in Egypt already for a third intifada. Also, violent demonstrations before the Israeli embassy in Cairo and the Israeli consulate in Alexandria. Israel will now have to produce a new strategy to handle this situation, both civilian and military. This is a paramount need for prayer. Pray for the chief of staff, pray for military and civilian intelligence chiefs, pray for all those in the sort of high-up military brass that they may know how to handle this new situation. Again and again, Israel has been saved by the foresight of its leaders, which must have been the Lord who prompted them to produce strategies that saved many lives in the day of trouble. We should mention what has been dubbed the Iron Dome. Certainly it shot out of existence a number of missiles fired by Hamas and its supporters. Whether it will be really and truly successful remains to be seen, but it does seem as if it has been successful so far. And the military from other countries are very, very interested in what has been dubbed the Iron Dome. That's the kind of strategy we need to pray that Israel will have for the future. I think also when I say anything about Israel, I should say something about the water situation. In the beginning of January, we were told it was dire. The former rains had failed, and we were told we could not expect that we would be able to pass through 2011 without much real problem water-wise. In fact, the Lord has sent much rain, and the Lake of Galilee, I saw it myself with my own eyes just a week ago, is about a meter below its normal mark. The fact that we're told there's still a water situation, I think, is because the water board is very afraid that everyone will use water unwisely, if they know that it's not quite as bad as was said. But the fact still remains that in the IFI, Intercessors for Israel, prayer conference in the last week of January, beginning of February, we prayed every day for the water situation, which at that point was dire. Now, I'm not saying we were the only people who prayed. There were many others who prayed as well. But thank God, it is amazing to me that we're coming back from the Galilee last weekend. We ran into four storms, one after the other, over Jerusalem. And now they're forecast another period of storms this weekend. That's all we will need to not only here in Jerusalem, but also in the Galilee, for the water to be brought right up. A really thing. So do pray for these storms and for heavy rain that will not do damage, but will finally balance the problem, at least for this year. We need to pray also for the government of Israel that they will not compromise or make concessions. So much stress and pressure is being exerted upon Bibi Netanyahu and upon the government to sort of make some kind of concession to Mahmoud Abbas. Mahmoud Abbas, now I will shock some people by what I'm going to say. Mahmoud Abbas is not a moderate, but a snake in the grass. This man planned the Olympic massacre of Israeli athletes. He is the architect of the stage-by-stage destruction of Israel, which was adopted by the PLO as its official policy in 1974, I think it was. But the fact still remains. Everyone says he is a moderate and that he's a far... Well, he does look different. I mean, every time I used to say, I thank God for Yasser Arafat, because every time he appeared on television, anywhere in the world, thousands of people became supporters of Israel. And now, of course, with Mahmoud Abbas, he seems a kindly enough old gentleman. And people speak of him as being so wonderful and for peace and all the rest of it. It's nothing of the kind. He is now riding high on a wave of pro-Palestinianism in the Western nations and in the world in general. In September, he plans a unilateral declaration of an independent Palestinian state with the 1967 borders. And this in the United Nations. He says that about between 130 and 180 nations have so far recognized Palestine as a state, a sovereign state. This is over half of the United Nations members. If Abbas takes this to the floor of the United Nations Assembly in September, he is bound to get a majority. Furthermore, and this is extremely serious for those of you who really pray for Israel, he has brought about a so-called reconciliation between Hamas and Fatah. I think you all know that Palestinian society has been rent in two by the election years ago of Hamas. Ever since there's been a bitterness. I mean, they've murdered one another in some instances, and some in the most terrible way. The incredible fact is that Hamas is demanding that Fatah withdraw its recognition of Israel, amongst other demands. The constitution of Hamas is clear. It is the destruction of the state of Israel. It's written there. Any one of you who wants to see the Hamas constitution, look it up. I am computer illiterate, but many of you who listen to me are not computer illiterate. So you can look it up, Google it, and have a look yourself. See what the constitution... How in the world is Israel going to make peace with a reconciled Fatah and Hamas when the Hamas side believes fervently in the destruction of Israel, refuses to recognize Israel as a Jewish state, in spite of the fact that Saudi Arabia is a Muslim state totally, and many others the same. It's incredible. Anyway, I want you to pray very greatly for this matter. Yesterday, the Hamas Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh condemned the assassination of Osama bin Laden, hailing him as a mujahid and as a great martyr and great Muslim. It came in the, he says, in the context of US policy of killing and repression of Muslims. I will finally say something about Iran. Iran is, of course, a non-Arab Muslim nation and has much to gain from the foment and revolution in the Arab nations. While she has not over-orchestrated it, she has a real finger in it. Already Egypt has moved to reopen relations with Iran. The problem for the Western and industrialized democracies has been the choice between dictatorial autocratic leaders keeping the stability of the country, even though the means by which they did it are highly questionable, and a genuine surge, popular surge, towards democracy in the Arab nations. Mubarak, Ben Ali, Assad, all of them have given stability to their nations while supporting them, whilst suppressing the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda and other basic human rights. Iran is another and supreme example. Khamenei, the president, and Ahmadinejad, its prime minister, rule with an iron fist. There is no freedom in Iran, only an Islamic and Quranic state. In the midst of enormous and contagious turmoil and conflict, revolutionary power, whilst the whole world is centred on the Japanese earthquake and its results, the Christchurch earthquake and its results, and the Arab foment, Iran is quietly pursuing the quest for nuclear. In the midst of all that has been happening in the world, the Japanese earthquake and terrible things, scenes that followed it, the Christchurch one, which was basically eclipsed by the Japanese earthquake, and then all this foment in the Arab world around encircling Israel, the Iran has simply quietly gone on with her nuclear program. Such quiet and determined pursuit of a purpose will undoubtedly achieve its end, sanctions or no sanctions. The Stuxnet virus and a new one will slow down the achievement of that purpose. But it will, in the end, be achieved. The United Nations and the world is basically impervious. One of these days, Iran will test her A-bomb, and the whole world will wake up to a new situation. It will not just be Israel or the Middle East, but the whole world. Iran, with nuclear devices, would be like Hitler if he had achieved that purpose with the A-bomb or H-bomb in his hands. The ghost of Osama bin Laden will haunt the world, and Iran will avenge him. This extraordinary situation will be the fault of the world at large. They have done very little to stop it, except indulge in a lot of hot air and platitudes. The consequences of Iran getting the bomb will be horrific, not just for Israel, but for the US, the United Kingdom, the EU, and even Russia. Now I'd like to say something about another non-Arab nation, but Muslim, that is Turkey. Turkey is another non-Arab Muslim nation. It is being continually held up now as a glorious picture of an Islamic democracy and an example for the whole Arab world to follow. There is in Turkey a huge Islamic revival taking place. It was this revival that brought Erdogan to power. He is now the prime minister and held up as an example of a moderate Muslim leader. Apart from the fact that Turkey and Iran have made an alliance under the auspices of President Bashar Assad of Syria, which fact should be a serious warning to us all. It is concerning that Turkey is a NATO member and is wanting also to enter the European Union. Turkey's human rights record is horrific. The treatment of minorities, of the Kurds, of Christians is flawed, to put it minimally. And her record of the Armenian genocide and the Syriac Christian murder between 1911 and 1917, the expulsion of the Greeks in millions in 1926, if this is the example for all the Arab nations, it can only seriously concern us. On top of all this, we have to record that Turkey's attitude towards press freedom is incredibly poor. According to the Human Rights Associations, Turkey ranks amongst the worst regimes in the world in the treatment of press freedom. At present, many journalistic reporters and press people have been arrested and are in prison without trial, as also are a number of top army officers. The army has always been the guardian, the traditional guardian, of Turkey's secular constitution. If we bring all this together, it is not a happy picture. It is cause for deep concern for the Middle East and in particular for Israel, and fuel for prayer and intercession. The change of Turkey, as of Iran formerly, from a close friend and partner of Israel to an avowed and determined antagonist and opponent, must have meaning for all you who seriously study God's prophetic word. I would like then to say something about the Godstone report. I think all of you will remember the report dubbed the Godstone report after Judge Godstone, a South African judge, which became the basis for enormous anti-Israel reporting and attitude. It was the single greatest cause for many nations believing that Israel had acted in an illegal and unjust manner in the Gaza war. Godstone, as I've already said, a South African judge whose investigation and report on South Africa also had great effect on that nation and its course. The media spent much time quoting his report on the Gaza war and made it the basis of their anti-Israel judgment. Now, Godstone has retracted an amount of his report, saying that if he had known then what he knows now, he would not have written what he wrote. But the damage is done. The world still believes the truth of his original report, the so-called truth. They spent hours over weeks on that report, in the media, but dismissed his recantation in minutes. Israel's reaction was understandable. He needed to reject the report, but this, of course, will never happen. Enormous damage was done to the name and reputation of Israel, and his recanting even quite an amount of it has not in any way changed the attitude built on his report. Lastly, I would like to say something before I come to a conclusion about the United Nations. This is the first time it has ever intervened in another sovereign nation, Libya. It is, as I've said, the first time that the United Nations intervened in a domestic war in a sovereign and independent member state. A resolution was tabled in the Security Council concerning Libya and Colonel Gaddafi's rule. It was unanimously passed with the abstention of 6 members, including Russia, China, Germany, and India. This made a military action by the United States or NATO legal. The United States pulled back after a while, and NATO came to the fore. Turkey dragged its feet with Germany and thus made the military action half-hearted. France and Great Britain had then taken the lead, seeking to put some body into the military action. So far, it has led to a virtual stalemate with the rebels on one side and Gaddafi's forces on the other. All this, please listen carefully, has tremendous and serious significance for Israel. If a resolution was tabled in the Security Council against Israel and for some kind of military action to be taken, and that resolution was not vetoed, it could result in the nations coming against Jerusalem as they have with Libya. It is a real consequence to note that the Arab League, led by Amr Moussa, a bitter critic and opponent of Israel, actually tabled a resolution on the floor of the Security Council seeking a binding no-fly zone over Gaza. It was vetoed. Thus, Libya has become a precedent. Is this all a pointer to what is going to happen in these next years? If so, the prophecy of Zechariah will be literally fulfilled. 3 times Zechariah prophesied that all the nations of the earth would come against Jerusalem. Zechariah 12, verse 3 and verse 9. Zechariah 14, verse 2. Are we now at the beginning of that era? The Lord says that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. This betokens enormous judgment on all those nations that take their side against Israel. Thus, it will not just be trouble for Israel and much conflict, but total destruction for those nations with all the attendant death, misery and injury, as well as economic ruin. Furthermore, if Israel is surrounded by armed enemies and all is seemingly lost, Israel will not hesitate to use her nuclear arsenal. Like the suicide of Matsuda when the Romans finally took it. I remember Golda Meir when Nixon was refusing to help Israel in the 73 war. Golda just said one sentence. Then she said, we will have to use our nuclear weapons. That changed Nixon immediately, and he put into effect an aerial supply of weapons in that war. It will be a scenario much like Ezekiel 38 and 39. It is a tremendous comfort to hear Zechariah prophesying that in the midst of this era, somewhere into it, when the nations come against Jerusalem, He will pour upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the house of David the spirit of grace and of supplication, and they shall look unto him whom they have pierced, and shall mourn for him as for an only son. We should take very seriously the words of the Lord Jesus. When these things begin to come to pass, look up, lift up your heads, your redemption draweth nigh. These are the birth pangs of the coming kingdom. There's something that we have to endure. There is something in which we have to be in it. We have to be faithful. But remember the psalmist. It doesn't matter if the mountains are cast into the sea and everything seems to change and shake to pieces. There is a river, the streams whereof make glad the city of God. And as far as we are concerned, that wonderful 93rd Psalm, the Lord reigns. Above the billows of the sea, the mighty roaring of the waves, the Lord on high is mighty. Dear child of God, use all this material as fuel for prayer for this nation, and not only for this nation, but for the faithful remnant in the nation from which you come. That God will protect them in the midst of all this judgment and make them to be faithful witnesses to others, to be able to pull out of the fire brands from the burning.